How do restrictions on worker mobility affect mergers and acquisitions? And what does this tell us about competition in labor and product markets? In this episode, we explore the economic effects of non-compete agreements and how their enforcement can influence firms' decisions to acquire competitors, retain employees, and compete for talent. On the occasion of the 53rd Annual Conference of the European Association for Research in Industrial Economics, or EWI, ZDW economist Bernhard Gangelmeier is joined today by Ginger Jin, professor at Boston University Quistram School of Business, to discuss these questions. Welcome to the ZDW podcast, Wirklich Wirtschaft.
ZEW, Wirklich Wirtschaft, kompakt. Ein Podcast des Leibniz-Zentrums für europäische Wirtschaftsforschung in Mannheim.
It's a great pleasure to have Ginger Jin here with me today. Ginger just joined Boston University as the Allen and Kelly Quistram Professor at the Quistram School of Business at Boston University. Ginger, welcome. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to talk a little bit about your paper that you'll present at ERIE this year. You study how regulation in labor markets, and in your case, the enforcement of non-compete clauses, affects merger and acquisition activity in that industry. Help us understand a little bit about how these two things are linked and how we should think about that link and what effects should we expect from that link.
Oh, definitely. The non-compete enforceability has been studied a lot by researchers and mostly focused on how that affects worker mobility. Merger and acquisition also studied by a lot of researchers in terms of whether merger and acquisition increase firms' market power in both the product market and the labor market as the buyer of labor as an input. In our paper, we try to put the two types of the labor friction in terms of non-compete and merger and acquisition together because we think there's a natural link. For example, the non-compete clause would restrict workers' mobility. Imagine you are a firm. You could try to hire that person away from your competitor, or you try to buy the whole firm. The NCA, the non-compete agreement, basically make it harder to hire this person, right? So naturally, you may want to buy the firm. So this intuitively should increase the probability that you want to buy the firm. So we work out a theory. The theory turns out a little more complicated than what I just described, because if the firm has been protected by the non-compete, it also raised the owner's reservation value to sell. So if the owner is more reluctant to sell, then the buyer have to pay a little more, right? So this become a countervailing force in terms of your willingness to buy. So we figure out the condition under which the firm would like to buy if the non-compete clause become more enforceable by the location of the target firm. We also bring this to the empirical exercise by matching the firms merged in PitchBook with the LinkedIn records of employees. So we can follow the employees after a firm has been acquired. And in particular, we try to distinguish so-called in-market acquire versus out-of-market acquire, because the non-compete enforceability should only apply for the in-market acquire, given that the person, if they move to another firm who compete with the target firm, is going to subject to the non-compete. But if you move out of that industry, then you're not subject to the non-compete. So all the mechanism I mentioned should have more bite for so-called in-market acquire than for the out-of-market acquire. So that's why we try to set up this link and also test it in the data. So you can imagine the data is not as clean as the theory just specified, right? Because, for example, you take California. California effectively has zero non-compete enforceability, but it also have a lot of firms, a lot of M&As. So it's not clear that the link we're looking after really exists in the data. However, we do find some evidence supporting the theory. In some states, for example, the states has biggest change in non-compete enforceability. We find that the bite occurs in extensive margins. So when the non-compete has more enforceability, we see more merger activities versus no merger activities. So that's on the extensive margin. And for the states that already have a lot of mergers, we see the effect on the intensive margin. That means, okay, the merger exists, but whether the acquirer is in market or out of market, we find that acquirer is more likely to be in market if the state of the target firm becomes more enforceable in the non-compete. So these are consistent with the intuition I just described. We also follow the employee after M&A. We see to what extent they stay with acquirer or they leave the acquirer. Generally speaking, the theory predicts that they should be more likely to stay with the in-market acquirer because, by definition, the non-compete is supposed to protect the employer, and we do see that on average in our data. However, condition on the person will move, the person is actually tends to move inside the market if the deal was done by an in-market acquirer. So to some extent, that may kind of counter the effect of retention mm-hmm. by this non-compete enforceability. So overall, I think we find support from the data for the theory, and we hope that this sort of highlight a novel connection between non-compete enforceability on the labor market and MA activity on the product market.
That's fascinating. It's also indicative of a growing interest of labor markets and as it interacts with the competition and competition enforcement on the product market and on the industry side. You talk about in markets and out of markets acquisitions. Does it also matter? Does the geographic composition of the merger also matter? Non-compete clauses are enforced at the state level. Does it matter whether the target or the acquirer is in a state where non-compete clauses are enforced as opposed to not? Have you looked at that?
Oh, definitely. Geography matters here because the non-compete enforcement is done by the state, by the local government. This is in the U.S. So we look at the target state. So that's where the target firm is headquartered. And we didn't look much on the acquirer's state because acquirer often tends to be much bigger. They could be global company, right? Even if they headquarter in California, if they buy a firm in Washington State, they may want to use the law, the non-compete law in Washington State to bound the employee there. So we look at the target state.
Right, because the focal employees live in Washington State. So it's Washington State's laws that apply here. Right. I understand. It's clear. There's one thing not in the paper itself. But can you speculate a little bit about how this link between labor markets and MA activity affects innovation? You mentioned in the paper equihires are concerned. Can you elaborate on that?
Oh yeah, that's a very good question. Unfortunately, we have not linked our data to patents or other measures of innovation, so I do not have definite answer to you. But I'm happy to speculate. And so the NCA, the non-compete agreement, basically kind of bound the employee to the firm. Okay, so to the extent that it helped the firm to invest more in that employee and create innovations inside the firm, that could be a positive effect. However, the lack of mobility to other firms could dampen the employees' incentive to invent, okay? And especially to maximize the value they can create from that invention. So if you take our research seriously, that's stronger non-compete enforceability actually invite in-market acquirers to acquire the firm. Mm-hmm. That's kind of another way of mobilizing the employment. And I think to that extent, it might be a good thing. But we also find employees are more likely to stay with the in-market acquirer. So mm-hmm. again, it depends on to what extent the in-market acquirer are willing to invest in this employee, invest in the specific resources this employee may need to invent new things. So that's kind of ambiguous answer. I also want to throw one more effect in this. If you're thinking entrepreneur may want to found a company, right? And they may look at exit strategy to what extent the company they found could be eventually get monetized through acquisition or through IPO. So that's just another wrinkle that's in this whole thing, right? If the entrepreneur is able to sell his company or easier to sell the company or go public, this could promote their incentive to invent on something new. So put all these together, I guess the prediction on innovation will be quite ambiguous.
So I see there are still a lot of open questions and avenues for future research. Let's hope that maybe at next year's ERI or in 2 years from now, we'll see more papers even either coming out of your research team or some other researchers who get inspired by your presentation this week. Speaking of ERI, do you recall your first ERI attendance or your most memorable attendance at ERI and why?
I think I was first invited to ERI as a keynote speaker in 2013. I think that's probably somewhere in Portugal. That was my first time to... It's hard to believe it's already over 12 years, 13 years after that. And I was quite impressed by the scope and the depths of the conference, even at my first time. That's 2013. So afterwards, I think I have attended ERI for multiple times.
Great. Do you have a personal highlight for this year's ERI, either on the program or sort of the backdrop on the surrounding here in Mannheim?
That's a good question. I just arrived last night, so very limited time for me to reflect on that. But I was quite impressed by the venue itself, the University of Mannheim, the palace, the Baroque palace is very impressive. And I was kind of lost in the building.
I've been here 6-7 years. I do get lost in the building myself on occasion. It is, if I'm not mistaken, the second largest palace in Europe, just after Versailles. One last point. You're also the managing editor at the International Journal of Industrial Organization, which is ERI's official house journal. As managing editor, I'm sure you see a strong increase in submissions of papers, partly triggered by the use of artificial intelligence these days. But as a managing editor, the journal in you as the managing editor, you're also interested in AI as it helps or affects the community or the research and industrial organization. There's a special issue coming out. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm glad to talk about the journal. The journal is titled International Journal of Industrial Organizations. So as the name suggested, we welcome submission from all over the world, and we do receive submissions all over the world. In terms of AI, we want to kind of highlight artificial intelligence and industry organization are inherently linked, and given that artificial intelligence may change firm behavior, may change individual creators' behavior, may change policymakers' mindset of exactly what to watch out for, we really want this special issue to kind of drive people's attention to this to this phenomena. I'm sure everybody is paying attention to artificial intelligence, but we want to kind of maybe highlight a special link between the artificial intelligence and the industrial organization. We welcome both theoretical and empirical submissions, as well as some pieces, thought pieces about ongoing policy debate, which area you think that's policymakers should pay attention to, through which angle, in particular, how that's related to firm behavior, to consumer behavior. Yeah, we welcome all of that.
Great. Can you remind our listeners of the deadline? When should they submit the papers?
The deadline is December the 31st of 2026.
We still have 5 months to go, four months to go. Good.
Yes. And perfect. Given AI's help, hopefully even new ideas could be crystallized into full paper by that time.
Wonderful. This has been a great pleasure. Ginger, thank you so much for chatting with me today. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Enjoy the rest of Mannheim. And if you do have some time, go on a stroll. The weather is beautiful and absorb what Mannheim has to offer.
Definitely. Thank you.
This was the ZEW podcast, Wirklich Wirtschaft, with Ginger Jin from Boston University Quistrom School of Business, recorded on the occasion of the 2026 ERI Annual Conference in Mannheim. You can find more information about the conference and research at ZEW on our website, zew.de, as well as in the show notes and on our social media channels. Thank you for listening and see you next time.